Now tonight, I want you to turn with me to the 24th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. The 24th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, beginning at verse 1. How many have your Bibles? Lift them up. Thousands of Bibles. The 24th chapter of Matthew's Gospel. These words. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. There are so many things. I could spend all evening just talking about Israel and the Jews. God's timepiece. This wonderful, magnificent people, chosen of God. Their country destroyed in 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar. And the Bible all the way through from one end to the other in scores of scriptures predicted there would come a day when they would be gathered from all over the world back to their own land. And in 1948, when President Truman recognized Israel as a state and the United Nations declared it as a state.
And God warned us with a prophecy from King Solomon that is called Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs, not to return in mass in large numbers back to Palestine.
And the Bible, the last days, is when Israel is reborn as a nation. That happened May 15th, 1948. In the Bible, the last days is when Jerusalem is under the control of the Jewish people. That happened in 1966 in the Six-Day War.
And because several chapters before, he had likened the nation of Israel to a fig tree, some people believe this parable was about the nation of Israel. That for 2,000 years, after 70 AD, when it was wiped off the face of the map, it came back into being as a result of the Holocaust and World War II, and the Jews came from all over the world. They reestablished the nation of Israel and the family of nations in May 1948.
Testons avance le fait que, d'après la Bible, le peuple juif doit retourner pour qu'il puisse y avoir la fin du monde, puisqu'il puisse y avoir le jugement dernier. Il faut d'abord que les Juifs soient retournés sur leur terre. Ils ont fait un problème.
For the first time in 2,500 years, and the Bible had predicted that these people, only 13 million in the whole world, scattered in the whole world, would be drawn back to their own land.
E purtroppo il sionismo ha voluto creare uno stato israeliano che nelle attese del vero popolo ebraico non c'era.
Jesus said, don't let it catch you like a thief coming in the night. You should not be surprised when that sky unfolds and Jesus comes back. We're expecting him to come and we have the signs to know what time it is. And the time is short. Watch, therefore, he says. Don't let anybody deceive you. Work. Don't grow weary in well-doing. Don't quit. Don't quit. Don't give up. And the closer we get to the end, the harder it's going to be. I wish I had another opportunity to tell you about the warfare that we're in, but I know you know about it.
And that war is graphically described in detail in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and I have presented that in a prophecy series before. Today, America and Israel are fighting for freedom against the world of Islamofascism. This is a religious war. President Bush has said, and I quote, this nation is at war with Islamic fascists. Rush Limbaugh said, this is a religious war. There's no room for compromise in a religious war. Cal Thomas said, it is life or death. We want to live, and they want us to die. Are there any questions? Ladies and gentlemen of America, we are at war with radical Islam, Islamofascism. Jihad has come to America. They're saying that there is 1.3 billion Islamics in the world.
D'après la Bible, le peuple juif doit retourner pour qu'il puisse y avoir la fin du monde, puisqu'il puisse y avoir le jugement dernier. Il faut d'abord que les Juifs soient retournés sur leur terre. Ils ont fait un problème religieux.
America's new Pearl Harbor was 9/11, when 19 radical Islamics, 15 of which were from Saudi Arabia, hijacked commercial airliners and flew them as missiles of death into the Twin Towers in New York City.
And I believe that's my generation. And Jesus said the generation that sees that take place is the generation that's going to see his return. And I believe, and let me just say it, okay? I believe if I live out my natural lifetime, I will live to see the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. I believe that we're living in the last generation before he comes back.
Listen to me very clearly. It's coming. It's coming. It could start tomorrow. it could start tomorrow. Jesus Christ is coming back to earth a lot sooner than you believe.
Io ho trovato, ho letto un libricino di un console americano della metà dell'Ottocento in cui già si parlava di cristiano sionismo, cioè si leggeva la questione di Gerusalemme come una questione che apparteneva alla cultura sia cristiana che giudaica.
La seule occasion pour les protestants, la seule, j'ai pas chance, mais la seule potentialité, le seul moment où les protestants vont pouvoir avoir un pied. Ce que les chrétiens appellent la Terre Sainte. On trouve les orthodoxes, les catholiques qui ont tous leur place à Jérusalem, au Saint-Sépulcre. Les protestants n'existent pas. Et si les économistes, les dirigeants plutôt des États-Unis, du côté économie, en fait, sont très intéressés par le pétrole, d'un point de vue idéologique, les protestants appuient le mouvement sioniste par conviction religieuse tout le temps à ce rappel de la Bible. Le serpent mordra sa queue, c'est-à-dire le peuple d'Israël rentrera en Israël. Il justifie en fait par le biais d'un texte sacré, d'un texte.
Protestantism is one of the three main sects of Christianity. Martin Luther was the person who wrote its principles. The word Protestant means objector or dissenter. The followers of this religious order were called Protestant because they opposed some of the rules of the Catholic Church. Martin Luther read the Old Testament and compared the Gospel to the Torah. Then he introduced some great innovations to Catholicism, saying that God had chosen the Jews was one of them. This belief did not last long, and he turned against the Jews and Judaism at the end of his life. One of his statements is worth thinking about. Jews carry the noblest blood in their veins. It was through them that the Holy Spirit promoted the Bible all over the world. They, the Jews, are children of God. Compared to them, we are strangers. As shown in the story of the Canaanite woman, we are like dogs eating the breadcrumbs of our masters. Preaching the Christian gospel, whose followers call it evangelism, is a branch of Protestantism. It was established in the 1730s in Britain. The evangelist's motto is returning to the gospel and changing the society. They wish to build a government in the US based on the gospel and the return of Christ. The evangelists believe that the only way to realize that is by supporting the Jews and establishing the Great Israel at the time of Armageddon.
D'après la Bible, le peuple juif doit retourner pour qu'il puisse y avoir la fin du monde, puisqu'il puisse y avoir le jugement dernier. Il faut d'abord que les juifs soient retournés sur leur terre. Ils ont fait un problème religieux. C'est-à-dire autant... autant eux, ils justifient leur action en Palestine, les massacres, la colonisation, le déplacement de population, l'enfermement de population dans des camps comme Gaza, par exemple.
Però anche con riferimento agli accenni che ho fatto sugli Stati Uniti nell'Ottocento, praticamente c'è un problema che è quello evidenziato da Walter Mersheimer nel loro libro sulla lobby pro-israeliana negli Stati Uniti, che è quella di una fortissima e crescente presenza della lobby e degli interessi, diciamo, del mondo ebraico sionista negli Stati Uniti per indirizzare la politica degli Stati Uniti appunto verso un'attenzione crescente al Medio Oriente, ovviamente con l'obiettivo di difendere essenzialmente Israele.
As the American Jewish lobby had an influence on American policy is not good for America? I don't think it's good for Israel. That's the most important
point. So not good for America or good for Israel?
For America, it's not very good at all, I think.
And they've had that amount of power in your judgment?
I think they have a considerable amount of power. Look at how legislation is passed, limiting freedom of action of the United States in the Middle East. All sorts of acts of legislation are being
passed. They're just efficient. It's a small amount, and they're efficient. AIPAC is American-Israeli Public Alliance Committee. It makes a convention once a year in Washington, in the largest convention hall, and almost every single politician, Democrat, Republican, President, majority leader, minority, everybody comes and bows down to, gives respect to the AIPAC. A congressman called Paul Finley wrote a book about this. You've heard of that? And he was an incumbent, I think he was a five-term congressman. He let himself speak openly that, for pro-Palestinian or sympathetic of Palestinian. And they decided that was it. So what the Zionists did was they simply found somebody to run against him, and they put in a tremendous amount of money into the other guy's campaign. Now what happens is, that's not such a big thing, it's only one congressman. But everybody takes an example from that. All the other congressmen says, listen, what am I, nuts?
E Kennedy probabilmente è il punto di svolta nel quale noi vediamo una radicale sconfitta di certe tendenze, espresse dall'amministrazione Kennedy, perché Kennedy fu colui che dialogava con Nasser, era il principale nemico di Israele perché aveva una posizione battagliera di recupero delle terre occupate da Israele, tutta la Palestina.
In their book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer conclude that if the Zionist lobby succeeds in implementing its policies in the U.S., Israel's enemies in the Middle East will weaken and crumble one by one. Then Israel will have a free hand in dealing with the Palestinians, while the U.S. will have to take on a great part of the war expenses and damages.
Non solo, ma Kennedy, fra i diversi peccati, oltre a dialogare con Nasser, a un certo punto, nel 63, mi pare 3-4 mesi prima dell'attentato di Dallas, scrive a il premier israeliano Levi Eshkol e gli chiede di far ispezionare agli americani la neonata centrale nucleare di Dimona. 3-4 mesi dopo Kennedy viene assassinato.
Et il faut quand même reconnaître que le seul pays du Moyen-Orient qui a la bombe, c'est Israël. Et Israël possède 400 têtes de missiles dans le centre de recherche de Dimona, dans le désert du Negev, et avec ces bombes, ils tiennent en otage toute la région. Moi qui suis une anti-nucléaire et qui suis pour le désarmement universel, je me dis que si Israël la bombe, il faut créer un autre pays qui l'a, l'Iran, pour qu'il y ait un équilibre entre les deux, comme ça aucun des deux ne peut l'utiliser. Il y a pas, ou soit on désarme Israël, soit on autorise l'Iran à avoir la bombe.
I don't think so. I think they're going to go to war with Iran because it's really not an American choice anymore. It's an Israeli choice and the choice of the American Jewish lobby. You'll notice when Obama wanted to talk about whether there should be war against the Iranians, he didn't go to the Congress, he didn't go to the American people, he went to AIPAC and more or less pled for more time to make sanctions work.
So how do you separate rhetoric, though, from reality? Because I've seen at AIPAC, Iran has been the top of their agenda for as long as I've been covering it. And clearly, there's plenty of documentation that AIPAC is, arguably the strongest foreign policy lobby in the United States. But how do we know that that will lead to some kind of attack and what that would look like?
Well, they're not only the most strongest, they're the most corrupting. They've corrupted the American political system, both in the Congress and on the campaign trail. Otherwise, who would pay attention to them if it wasn't for money?
Well, can you give us some examples that you feel substantiate that
point? Well, look at Senator Lieberman. Senator Lieberman is the voice of Israel in the Congress, no matter what's in the interest of the American people, and he champions IPAC and the rest of those organizations.
Do not let anyone tell you that a nuclear-armed Iran is just Israel's problem. It is not.
Do you think that the American people really want to go to war to protect the Israelis' interests? I don't think so. We intervened in Libya. We intervened in Iraq. We're going to follow the Israeli lead and intervene into Iran. And the bottom line is none of those countries pose a threat to the United States in even the remotely distant future. And we are going to further destroy our own economy for the interests of the Israelis, their lobby, and the people they control in both American political parties.
Per esempio, l'episodio che viene raccontato da Gor Vidal e che a Gor Vidal sarebbe stato riferito da John Kennedy, che praticamente durante la campagna elettorale per l'elezione del nuovo presidente dopo la morte di Roosevelt e c'era una fase di presidenza ad interim di Truman, un rappresentante della comunità ebraica si presentò da Truman con una valigetta carica di 2 milioni di dollari e gli promise la vittoria elettorale in cambio del riconoscimento dello Stato di Israele, perché siamo appunto nel 47-48.
The extent of the Zionist lobby's influence on U.S. foreign policies has increased considerably. It started before the establishment of Israel.
What if the Prime Minister of Israel called you on the phone and said, our bombers are on the way, we're going to bomb Iran? What do you
say? Bob, let's not go into hypotheticals of that nature. Our relationship with Israel, my relationship with the Prime Minister of Israel is such that we would not get a call saying our bombers are on the way.
When I've sent young men and women into harm's way, I always understand that that is the last resort, not the first resort.
Of course, a military action is the last resort.
And it should not be forgotten that the U.S. has spent more than half of its budget on wars that mostly happened under the Democrats' tenure. As many experts say, many of these wars are not America's wars.
And Israel itself as a country is not the problem. The real problem is the leaders of the Jewish American community in the United States who influence and corrupt our Congress to support Israel when we have no interest there.
So let me ask you this. Who would want to create the impression that we need to engage in military activity, which a lot of the neocons demanded before the ink was even dry on this criminal complaint against Iran?
Oh, the only people that would benefit from that would be the Israelis and the Saudis. And I think if I was looking at a counterintelligence operation to decide where this information came from, I'd be very interested to see if I could find an Israeli hand or a Saudi hand. Because in the long run, Judge, both Israel and Saudi Arabia are much more dangerous enemies to the United States than the Iranians are.
You imply that the Israeli lobby is dragging the United States into the wars, into
Absolutely.
The conflict?
They're absolutely dragging us in. Iraq was a war that was proffered or was called for.
Interview 2011, in an interview with the Financial Times, you said, I disagreed with the President Obama, his decision to surge in Iraq, as I did with President Bush on the surge in Iraq. Do you stand by that? Those comments, Senator Hagel?
Well, Senator, I stand by them because I made them. And
but were you right? Were you correct in your assessment?
Well, I would defer to the judgment of history to sort that out. But
the committee deserves your judgment as to whether you were right or wrong about the surge.
I'll explain why I made those comments. And
I want to know if you were right or wrong. That's a direct question. I expect a direct answer.
The surge assisted in the objective. But if we review the record a little bit.
Will you please answer the question? Were you correct or incorrect when you said that the surge would be the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam. Were you correct or incorrect? Yes or no?
My reference to the search being the most dangerous.
Senator Hagel, the question is, were you right or wrong? That's a pretty straightforward question.
Well,
I would like to answer whether you're right or wrong, and then you are free to elaborate.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no answer
well,
on a lot of things.
Well, let the record show that
today.
You refuse to answer that question. Now, please go ahead.
One fundamental question that I asked myself on every vote I took, every decision I made, was the policy worthy of the men and women that we were sending into battle and surely to their deaths?
Una guerra preceduta da una grande menzogna mediatica della grande stampa legata alla lobby israeliana che parla di armi di distruzione di massa che non esistono, che non esistevano, e contro cui si schiera agli inizi di marzo un congressista americano, Jim Moran, che dice a Bush, cosa stai facendo? Tu non stai difendendo gli interessi degli Stati Uniti, tu stai difendendo gli interessi di Israele.
In a magazine interview, Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia hits the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. AIPAC is the most powerful lobby and has pushed this war from the beginning. I don't think they represent the mainstream of American Jewish thinking at all, but because they are so well organized, they have been able to exert power.
Immediatamente questo deputato coraggioso viene aggredito, antisemita, anti-israeliano, razzista, eccetera, e quindi chiede subito scusa.
We're not allowed to be highly critical of the state of Israel. And the other thing we're not allowed to do is discuss the notion that Israel and the notion of Israeli interests may in fact be dictating what America is doing, that what we're doing in the Middle East may not be to the benefit of America's national security, but to Israel's national security. But see, we don't want to talk about that because one of the great success stories out there is the pro-Israeli lobby that has successfully enabled themselves to blend the two together so that when we speak of Israeli interests, they say, no, we're speaking of American interests. It's interesting that AIPAC and other elements of the Israeli lobby don't have to register as agents of a foreign government.
Let's get the proportions straight, okay? AIPAC is a powerful lobby. It has a lot of money. It has wealthy contributors, right? We're talking about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, I think it is. It does a lot of advocacy work for Israel. It wants foreign aid for Israel, military aid for Israel. It pursues other goals that are valuable for the Israelis. But you have to understand, AIPAC acts on Congress. It can be decisive in the House of Representatives, less so for the Senate, and still less so for the presidency. But even here, we're talking about the elected, legal, visible government. It's fine to have a lot of power over the Congress. You can get large sums of money. But the power of the U.S. Congress is limited. In some ways, the U.S. Congress is a joke. It's not a very powerful branch of government. So if AIPAC, even if they dominate Congress, which they can't always do, if they dominate the Congress, we always have to remember that the locus of real power is very often this other entity, right? The interface of Wall Street with the Pentagon, the CIA, and the State Department. This is where power is found. No, the secret government, the invisible government, the parallel government. Remember, the United States is ruled by finance. It is not ruled by industrial interests or even the military-industrial complex.
AIPAC is definitely a part of that. The AIPAC, as a lobby for Israel, Israel works very closely with the United States government. Israel is seen as the American bulldog in the Middle East to effectuate American policy in the region. So AIPAC as the lobbying arm in Congress for the secular Zionists, is it the case of the tail wagging the dog, or is it the dog wagging the tail?
The political reality is that intimidate a lot, not you, but the Jewish lobby intimidates a lot of people in there. And again, I've always argued against some of the dumb things they do because I don't think it's in the interest of Israel. I just don't think it's smart for Israel. Now, everyone has a right to lobby, as it should be. And come see your senator and congressman. If you can get the guy to sign your letter, great, wonderful. But as I reminded somebody not too long ago, in fact, it was a group I was speaking to in New York, and we got into a kind of an interesting give and take on Iran. And a couple of these guys said, well, we should just attack Iran. I said, well, it's an interesting problem. We're doing so well in Iraq.
Right.
And I said, it would really help Israel. And I said, so this guy kept pushing. And he alluded to the fact that, well, maybe I wasn't supporting Israel enough or something. And I don't know how we get. And I just said, well, let me clear something up here if there's any doubt in your mind. I said, I'm a United States senator, not an Israeli senator. I'm a United States senator.
We're sitting down with Michael Scheuer, the man who had served in the CIA for more than 20 years up until 2004. At one time, he was the chief of the CIA Bin Laden unit. Then he went and exposed how counter-effective Washington's methods were in the fight against terror. He looked at the U.S. through its enemy's eyes. In fact, it's the title of one of his books called Through Our Enemy's Eyes. I'm very pleased to have the chance to interview you,
Thank
Mr. Scheuer.
I'm glad to be here.
If the U.S. pulls out of everywhere,
yes,
is it going to be the end of terrorism?
It certainly would deny the terrorists the glue of unity that keeps them focused on the United States. If we weren't the main enemy, they would be attacking Israel, they would be attacking the Saudis, they would be attacking the Moroccans. The war would be
And would you say let them attack
let them go.
The Israelis and the Saudis?
Let them go. Sometimes they say the Chinese will come in. I said, let the Chinese deal with these people for the next 50 years. We've had enough of it.
Stop confusing the American public that Israel's interests are necessarily America's interests. I have to tell you right now, Israel has a valid concern about Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. If I were an Israeli, I'd be extremely concerned about Hezbollah, and I would want to do everything possible to nullify that organization. As an American, I will tell you, Hezbollah does not threaten the national security of the United States of America one iota. So we should not be talking about using American military forces to deal with the Hezbollah issue. That is an Israeli problem, and yet you'll see the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other media outlets confusing the issue. They want us to believe that Hezbollah is an American problem. It isn't, ladies and gentlemen. Hezbollah was created 3 years after Israel invaded Lebanon, not 3 years after the United States invaded Lebanon, and Hezbollah's sole purpose was to liberate southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation. I'm not here to condone or sing high praises and virtue for Hezbollah, but I'm here to tell you right now, Hezbollah is not a terrorist organization that threatens the security of the United States of America.
The Israeli lobby has always tried to suggest that the U.S. and Israel are always on the same page, but the difference and divergences in their interests have sometimes led to warnings and oppositions from U.S. presidents. For example, tensions between the U.S. president and the Israeli prime minister over their differences on the Iranian nuclear issue and military attack increased considerably after a while. So much so that when Netanyahu visited the U.S. in September 2012, Obama refused to meet him.
We begin with a very public and new escalation of some tension between President Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israeli sources tell me the White House, at least for now, has rejected Prime Minister Netanyahu's request to meet with President Obama later this month to discuss Iran's nuclear program. Those same sources tell me the Israelis were told a meeting isn't possible because of the president's schedule. Schedule, they say, won't permit it, even when the Israelis offered to have the prime minister come to Washington from New York, where he'll be addressing the United Nations.
E siccome Netanyahu odia Obama,
lo considera un proprio nemico e preferirebbe avere un presidente repubblicano negli Stati Uniti.
Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham, they issued a statement. They were pretty upset about this inability, apparently, for Netanyahu and the president to get together. Let me put it up on the screen and read it to you. It is puzzling that the president can't make time to see the head of state of one of America's closest allies in the world. If these reports are true, the two senators go on to say, the White House's decision sends a troubling signal to our ally Israel about America's commitment at this dangerous and challenging time. You were at a meeting recently. The Israeli Prime Minister was there. The U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, was there. This is a U.S.-Israeli strategic cooperation meeting. And apparently there were some angry words exchanged. Just set the record straight for us. What happened there?
Well, I can tell you that I walked out of the meeting with the understanding that the Israeli government is a little frustrated with the lack of certainty on behalf of the United States.
Quindi io così interpreto la situazione. Israele è sempre servito come strumento per dividere gli arabi. Ci è riuscita perfettamente. E nello stesso tempo è sempre servita per mantenere gli arabi in uno stato di soggezione. E quindi c'è una palese alleanza tra Israele e l'Arabia Saudita, paradossale. Sauditi sono musulmani, non sono ebrei, ma Israele e Arabia Saudita hanno sempre lavorato di comune accordo, sistematicamente.
Mi dite pas che l'Arabia Saudita è una democrazia, non fate rigoler, c'è pas una democrazia. Le Qatar c'è una democrazia, no. En Arabie Saoudite, les femmes n'ont même pas le droit de conduire une voiture. Me dites pas que c'est une démocratie, regardez le Qatar. En fait, l'Occident préférerait un Moyen-Orient qui soit dominé par Israël. Voilà ce qu'ils préféraient. Et pour eux, ce serait ça la démocratie. Parce qu'ils s'en foutent que les pays soient des dictatures du moment qu'ils ont reconnu Israël et qu'ils commercialisent avec Israël. Parce que la liberté d'expression existe en Occident, mais pas par rapport à Israël. Il n'y a aucune liberté d'expression en Israël. Regardez ce qui m'est arrivé à moi. Moi, quand je me suis prononcé pour la décolonisation de toute la Palestine, ils m'ont envoyé 4 mecs du Betar. Et le Betar, c'est une organisation d'extrême droite juive qui sont venus chez moi à la maison avec des casques et qui m'ont cogné et qui m'ont laissé à moitié dans le coma. Tout simplement parce que je me suis exprimé contre Israël.
Perché, come dicevo prima, esiste alla base un'idea religiosa. Su quella terra ci devono stare solo gli ebrei. E quindi si tratta di uno stato confessionale, esplicitamente confessionale, razzista, perché stabilisce una demarcazione tra ebrei e palestinesi invalicabile, per cui gli ebrei, cioè gli ebrei e i palestinesi, essendo due religioni diverse, sono incompatibili. Punto fine.
Welcome back to Hardball. We're back with the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. His new book is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And President Carter, why did you use the word apartheid in the book's title?
But there's no doubt that within the occupied territories, Palestinian land, that there is a horrendous example of apartheid. The occupation of Palestinian land, the confiscation of that land that doesn't belong to Israel, the building of settlements on it, the colonization of that land, and then the connection of those isolated but multiple settlements, more than 200 of them, with each other by highways on which Palestinians can't travel, and quite often where Palestinians cannot even cross. So the persecution of the Palestinians now under the occupying territories is under the occupation forces is one of the worst examples of human rights deprivation that I know. What is being done to the Palestinians now is horrendous in their own territory by the occupying powers, which is Israel. They've taken away all the basic human rights of the Palestinians, as was done in South Africa against the blacks.
Perché purtroppo è l'ideologia sionista che è portatrice di un razzismo. Purtroppo è portatrice di un razzismo che aggredisce i palestinesi non a schiena ziti, cioè gli ebrei non ashkenaziti da parte degli ashkenaziti.
הסודנים הם סרטן בגוף שלנו. אנחנו נעשה את הכל להחזיר אותם בחזרה למקום מוצאם.
I have right now a young man and his wife with two children, expecting a third, sitting in my house now that they just left 3 months ago or something like that, Palestine, and they're waiting to, you know, somehow get you know, citizenship and so forth in the U.S. And this is ongoing. Tens of thousands of Jews leave because they don't, not because they're forced out, because they don't want to be under the Zionist occupation.
Parlare poi dei comportamenti razzisti con i palestinesi è fuori luogo, perché si sa tutto quello che accade, fin dalle targhe con il colore diverso, questi poveri sionisti che portano la storia di millenni di persecuzioni con le stelle gialle nei paesi occidentali non si rendono conto.
The Israelis are the only ones who have stood up and said democracy may not be very good for our security, and they couldn't be more correct.
Però la cosa più importante da sapere oggi è che la realtà di Israele è una realtà drammatica.
Why? Because in 30 years from now the majority will be Arabs, statistically, or something like that. And they're going to pledge allegiance to the Jewish state? It's totally doesn't make sense. Or this, or that it's called the Jewish state when you have the majority, you know, Muslims. Is the whole concept of keeping a country that it has to be a Jewish state amongst Arab and Muslim people who don't want this, and telling the people who live there, the refugees from Jerusalem, that they can't go back, it's all ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. It has to implode.
E siccome il problema esplode per forza di cose, perché i palestinesi li puoi sottomettere, li puoi schiacciare, ma non li puoi cancellare. O non li puoi costringere ad andarsene via del tutto, perché sono tanti e perché crescono di numero, diventano sempre più numerosi. E allora? E allora sarà guerra permanente.
It's flawed. The state of Israel is flawed in its essence. It's flawed in what it did. It stole the land from people. So think about it. It could be changed. If South Africa could have been changed, why can't Israel be changed?
L'État d'Israël, que les antisionistes appellent l'entité, parce qu'ils ne reconnaissent pas sa légitimité, a été créé comme base militaire. Il y avait Madame Skandrani, que vous avez interviewée, qui disait qu'il était un juif antisioniste et qui disait Palestine terre nourricière et Israël base militaire. Hein, c'est une base militaire.
J'ai participé à la première intifada en 1987 avec les Palestiniens. J'ai été dans les villes, dans les villages, je me suis mobilisé, j'ai participé aux manifestations. Et je me suis même pris une balle dans le bras. J'ai eu une balle dans le bras, ils m'ont envoyé une balle en caoutchouc qui a rebondi par terre. Heureusement qu'elle a rebondi par terre parce que c'est 90% de métal et 10% de caoutchouc. Parce que le gamin qui était à côté de moi, il l'a pris dans la tête, il est mort. Et c'était à Ramallah. Et c'était en 1989.
What we can do is what we do do is not enough, maybe. I mean, certainly not enough. We get up and we say that we point our fingers at the Zionists. We say, you are the root cause of the bloodshed. Your hands are covered in blood of both the Jews, both the Palestinian people that don't think you're a solution and don't think you're from God. You are the ones who have brought the Palestinian claim is the right, in the right.
I'm a witness. I know the Arabs. The Arabs are very good. No problem till the Zionist movement starts. My grandmother tell me before the Zionist movement starts, they babysitting each other, the kids. They bar off and watch each other like brothers. Like brothers. Like brothers. Here, the Zionists take away the land. from the Palestinians to the Arabs, starting the whole fighting. Not Arabs the problem, not Jews the problem, not Judaism, not Muslim, only Zionists.
C'est le grand ethnologue, anthropologue Lévi-Strauss qui disait, qui était juif lui-même, qui n'avait d'ailleurs pas particulièrement de sympathie pour l'islam. Il n'y a qu'à voir les pages de Triste Tropique qu'il consacre à l'islam, et qui disait de manière tout à fait raisonnée que l'État d'Israël n'avait pas d'avenir, que c'est un État qui était voué à disparaître, exactement comme tous les royaumes francs issus des croisades qui se sont installés au Moyen-Orient ont disparu au bout de 50 ans, un siècle et demi, mais qu'il n'y a pas d'avenir pour un État européen dans cette région du monde.
If we weren't the main enemy, they would be attacking Israel, they would be attacking the Saudis, they would be attacking the Moroccans. The war would be
And would you say let them attack
let them go.
The Israelis and the Saudis?
Let them go. But I think the point is the Americans can't get out. We're dependent on the Saudis to maintain our interests in the world oil market, and the Saudis buy, next to the Chinese, more of our debt than anyone else. So as long as we're side by side with the Saudis and with the Israelis, we're stuck in the Middle East.
Più importanti ebrei dei tempi moderni, da che c'è lo Stato di Israele, si sono staccati. Cominciamo da Albert Einstein, Erich Fromm, Hannah Arendt, e che vogliamo dire, basterebbero questi tre, e poi mettiamoci pure...